Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, South Africa's counter G20 summit kicks off with a warning to global powers. The G20 gender deadlock deepens. The B20 faces renewed demands to put Africa's health resilience at the heart of its agenda. And cartoonist Zapiro marks 30 years of skewering South Africa with a new compendium of chaos. It's Thursday, the 20th of November. Now let's start with this. And South Africa hosts the G20 summit this weekend, but not everyone is convinced that the event speaks for ordinary people. Civil society groups have launched a parallel so-called People's Summit to challenge what they call an elite-driven agenda that ignores inequality, debt relief and climate justice. Joining me now is Mazibuko Jaga, who is Executive Director of the Zabalaza Pathways Institute, part of the initiative. A very warm welcome to you. You've labelled the official process as an elite capture of crisis solutions. On what basis do you claim the commitments are more optics than action?
Hi, Jeremy and your listeners. The G20 is largely men in suits with a huge disconnection with ordinary people. They have not even initiated a public process to ask for our inputs, yet they are going to reach deals that actually serve corporate interests. This has been the history of the G20. It will continue being so. That is why we are convening this People's Summit, so that we can look at policy proposals that we want to forcefully table at the G20. For example, one of those proposals is how to make the tax system more just, so that the 1% of rich and richest people can pay their fair share of the tax.
What does forcefully table mean?
Forcefully table means that we are actually forcing our space into the public conversation. But also on Saturday, we will have public action to mobilize thousands of people in the country to demonstrate in support of these demands. By forceful, I do not mean anything more than that.
You talk of taxing billionaires and cancelling debt, all well and good, but how realistic are demands like that in the framework of the G20's current power dynamics? Is anyone actually going to listen to you?
In July 2000, President Mbeki didn't listen to anyone on HIV/AIDS treatment. It was people's action that forced him. Similarly here, we're going to do that. There was no discussion in the country about the just transition, but people on the ground, trade unions, forced that discussion to such that President Ramaphosa had to set up a presidential climate commission. So we're not blind to the fact that power is in favor of the powerful, but we can challenge that power through public education, through concrete policy proposals, lobbying and advocacy, and even court action. Many people in different parts of the world are already doing that.
Now, the South African government says the theme of the G20 presidency is, and I quote, solidarity, equality, and sustainability, all descriptors that your summit would talk to. From your viewpoint, then, is that just window dressing, or do you see some genuine change that is at least being proposed by the South African government?
I think there's a genuine commitment to those values, but at the same time, those values are contradicted by the fact that the very same government allows mining companies to pollute, allows illicit financial flows in the billions to leave our country, does not have a fair redistributive tax system. So we think much more needs to be done beyond words on banners.
Your People's Summit emphasizes, and I quote, "We the 99% and grassroots voices." But how do you ensure that your gathering is more than symbolic? How would you like to see this translated into durable policy outcomes? Or is that just a reach too far for you, do you think?
It is not. The first instance immediately after the summit is to deepen public education so that these proposals can be owned by people on the ground. The next thing is to target next year's budget so that when Minister Godongwana tables the budget, we can say, here is a people's budget alternative. Already, campaigners on climate justice and food sovereignty have developed a Food Sovereignty Act, and they tabled it to Parliament, such that Parliament is now actually seriously considering an act focusing on food sovereignty. On many of these demands, we will continue to do so, but also a number of various NGOs are sitting in government panels and government processes to advise ministers. So we're influencing the space in that way.
There is the argument that a counter summit like yours only preaches to the converted and doesn't change decisions that are made behind closed doors. What would your measurement of success be for this mobilization today and this weekend?
By coming together as people from more than 40 countries, we learn from different struggles, things we did not know. That is important. But also we galvanize action based on the things we did not know. Again, I'll go to the HIV/AIDS example. When we convened parallel summits during that World AIDS Summit, we learned so much about the politics, the science and economics of HIV/AIDS and also of treatment. Similarly here, we are learning on debt, we are learning on financial flows, on taxation, on climate justice, on climate debt. But beyond learning, as I was saying earlier, then the demand, the requirement is that we go to the ground, to communities, to take the message to that level, so that also communities can connect the pollution they see in the Vaal River to the bigger system of climate pollution, such that then they can actually concretize demands informed by the lessons we make, demands on the provincial government, demands on the national government, on the Presidential Climate Commission, not just demands, but also policy alternatives.
And just a final question, if the G20 summit ends with the same old commitments, but no substantial redistribution as you're calling for, what's your next step and how far are you prepared to go?
We will not be surprised if the G20 summit ends in that way. That would mean that we must deepen the pressure at country level. That must mean also that we deepen the pressure at global level. That will mean marches to parliament. That will mean submissions. That will mean community meetings. But also it will mean producing alternative budgets. For example, at municipal level, people in Grahamstown through the Unemployed People's Movement are already producing alternative budgets to demonstrate how that municipality is failing and how actually there's a real alternative emerging from the people.
Thank you very much indeed. That is Mazibuko Jaga, who is from the People's Summit. I appreciate your time.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, as the G20 wrestles with deepening geopolitical tensions, another quiet but consequential crisis is emerging: the collapse of consensus on women's rights. For a second year in a row, Argentina is the fly in the G20 Women's Empowerment Working Group ointment, preventing it from securing even a basic agreement on long-standing gender language. That signals a troubling rise in anti-rights sentiment within one of the world's most influential forums. So to help us understand what this deadlock reveals about global politics and what it means perhaps for South Africa's presidency, I'm joined now by Tsega Tefera, who is a senior G20 researcher at the Institute for Economic Justice. And Tsega, first of all, what does this breakdown then tell us about the state of global cooperation when it comes to gender inequality? I think I've used the word fragile, and that would surely describe it.
Yeah, so as you rightly described it, it has both political, symbolic, and institutional meaning, the breakdown. It shows that the political will to advance women's rights is under strain. And it's also a setback for gender policy coherence, especially on previously agreed and established language that was agreed in the Beijing Platform for Action and elimination of all forms of discrimination against women. And it undermines the continuity of the feminist policy cooperation within the G20. institutionally, it limits the influence of the G20 in shaping the agenda worldwide, and it delays progress on coordinated action for women empowerment.
Explain to us, if you can, what triggered the deadlock?
The G20 operates on a consensus, not like by a majority vote. So all G20 members, including the European Union, must agree for the declaration to be adopted. And there, especially one country, had a reservation with regards to wording that it perceived as ideologically motivated. There are other countries who had issues with certain terminologies, but they were willing to compromise. But that was not, you know, the position of everyone. And because of that, consensus could not be reached.
What do you think then it says about the rise of far-right and conservative politics within the G20 itself?
Signals economic pressures, economic security, and labor market disruptions. You know, like how the traditional breadwinner group is being threatened. And it's also related to demographic pressures. In some countries, there is already a belief that this gender ideology is fueling, you know, the falling birth rates. And there's also cultural change in gender norms. Yeah, so there is an anti-gender movement saying that as women participation rises, it's threatening male dominance, it's threatening culture, values, religion, yes, even sovereignty.
So how damaging do you think it is for the process itself, but also for South Africa's presidency of the G20, that this consensus was unable to be reached?
Yeah, it, like I said, it definitely signals that there is a strain in multilateral cooperation to advance women's empowerment. But South Africa as a country, I mean, it demonstrated exceptional principled visionary leadership by centering the care economy, the financial inclusion of women, and the eradication of gender-based violence and femicide at the center of the G20 agenda. And under its leadership, like a lot of knowledge sharing was fostered, like in terms of producing policy briefs and all that. And in the end, despite the challenge, you know, like the push to have a consensus, it stood its ground by showing that it will not regress back on gender terminology. It's showing accountability to not only to the South African women and girls, but women and girls worldwide.
Do you think as a result of this failure to reach consensus that we've reached something of a nexus point, that the signal, the moment, maybe looks at gender norms reversing rather than advancing?
Yeah, I would have to admit it's a very scary time. It's a contest over democracy, rights and justice. Very scary. So that's why I think we cannot just, civil society and governments who are, more progressive in terms of gender equality, you know, they cannot allow any setback. So they need to definitely rethink strategy, maybe crafting messages to link gender equality with shared societal goals like economic resilience, demographic sustainability, social cohesion. Yeah, we have to push back the pushback, you know, because hard-won gains are like now fragile. We have seen how easily things that were agreed for decades can be, eroded.
And I think this moment also then tests global commitment to sustainable development goals on gender, as you've suggested to me. You're going to have to go back to the drawing board here.
Yes, definitely. We need to rethink alliances, maybe not just the traditional like-minded groups, maybe work with religious activists, not just feminist groups, and also to bring in men and boys as partners. We have to rethink the way, you know, feminist economics and gender-related issues are popularized. We need to make it a societal issue. It's not just a woman's issue. It is a societal issue. I don't think this can be left out to governments alone. Civil society has to work, not just nationally, but internationally, because anti-gender activists do that. We now see a much broader international alliance against progressive gender norms. All stakeholders who care about gender equality needs to know what's at stake. It's not just the G20, it's every forum. Proactively, we need to make sure that the gender language is defended. And there won't be any regression with bodily autonomy and all the things that have been agreed for a long time now.
You talk about regression. Is there any way that this particular issue can find its way back into the G20 in any kind of forum or agenda at all? Or are you now looking beyond the G20 to reignite this issue?
Unfortunately for the Empowerment of Women Working Group in the G20, for the 2 years in a row, it did not achieve a declaration. Definitely, maybe in the future, maybe in the future G20 groups, this issue will come again and again. And I think we'll have to fight the good fight every time.
Do you think, reflecting back on the way in which the negotiations took place, that female leaders within the G20 itself harnessed enough collective power to shift the tone and the agenda? Do you think that some of the fault may lie internally in the way in which the negotiation process actually occurred?
I can't say so, because so many delegates around the table agreed to these issues. Everyone but one country, like I said. So it's just the way the G20 operates, that one country can hinder you from having that declaration. And the same country that did the last year. But there is already pressure. There was a lot of pressure throughout the year on this country. For instance, having a zero deficit fiscal policy means that the country could not commit to put the necessary resources to protect women from gender-based violence, or do not believe in inclusivity, instead of saying it should be merit-based, there shouldn't be any gender-responsive action by government. So it's not just an issue of, you know, like ideology. It's also an economic issue.
And do you buy that excuse?
I don't, because I don't see, any activity that works towards equality as a cost or as a constraint. From the perspective of gender justice, anything that you do towards equality or inclusivity is not a cost. A cost is leaving the people behind.
Yeah, I mean, that makes absolute sense. You talk about the need for a more assertive messaging. What do you think moving forward then it's going to take for women empowerment to become a non-negotiable pillar of multilateral governance, something along the lines of trade or climate, which the delegates seem to have got to grips with a lot more assertion, I think.
Every time this issue is raised, I think the more progressive countries have to come and say no. South Africa has indicated that it will not go back on agreed terminology. It would be against its constitution and its accountability to the women and girls of South Africa, and also its responsibility to the world. This is also politically motivated. You know, right-wing governments are gaining grounds in many countries, and blocs are developing. There would be much stronger push against countries like South Africa in the future. And I think it needs to come back and, you know, respond the same way again and again, saying that this is non-negotiable.
What do you think is at stake then for the G20's credibility if gender equality falls off the table completely, which it seems to have, certainly looking at the early negotiations?
Yeah, it's not a good look. But like I said, I think in this case, instead of having a very watered down declaration, it's better to have a chair statement that's much stronger, reflects where the world is right now. And I would say 19 countries have agreed to that very strong chair statement that has all the elements of the care economy, the gender-based violence and femicide, and financial inclusion.
Let me ask you this in conclusion then. If you had to write a line or a paragraph then for the G20's closing communique, what should it say about women empowerment and global responsibility moving forward?
It should say that hard-won gains can quickly be erased if they are not actively defended, and we must turn this setback into a moment of renewed global solidarity.
Thank you very much indeed. I do appreciate the conversation. That is Sedgar Tafera, Senior G20 Researcher at the Institute for Economic Justice. And I think the discussion reminds us that equality is not a side issue. It really is a test of whether global leadership still has moral authority. And when consensus fails, as you've been hearing in this conversation, there's no doubt that courage has got to take its place.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Health resilience is one of the strongest messages coming out of the B20 this week, with leaders warning that Africa cannot afford another crisis to catch its systems unprepared. From vaccine localization to tackling the rising tide of non-communicable diseases, what happens here is going to shape the continent's economic future as much as its health outcomes. Jean-Baptiste Brejean, head of Sanofi South Africa, is with me now. And it's an important issue, Jean-Baptiste, and thank you very much for joining us. If health resilience is now an economic priority, what, in your opinion, the company's opinion, is the one shift that Africa needs to make immediately?
Thanks again for this interview. I will just apologize from the start because you may hear a bit of noise behind, but we're just live from the convention center in Johannesburg for the B20 summit, which Sanofi is part of. So I will be right to your question. I think one of the biggest shifts for me, and this is a message that we're trying to get through with all the stakeholders, is that health, whether you talk about non-communicable disease, when you talk about infectious disease, when you talk about localization, it's all about investment and not a spending and a cost line. And this is what we're trying to get through in our conversation. When you look at Africa today, having the challenge of having a significant growing population, NCDs, non-communicable disease on the rise, such as chronic respiratory disease. The non-communicable disease in particular, you see, is at the intersection of so many topics around environment, social, economics, etc. So what we're saying to the different governments, institutions, supranational organizations, is that we must get out of the spending modes to an investment modes where we're asking the government to actually help us to provide access by investing and putting more funding behind tackling those issues.
What do you think is the resistance then from government in that respect? Why are they not being more forthcoming with that funding?
Yeah, well, I think it's just a matter of short-term challenges. I mean, obviously, we know that all governments have significant budget pressures. It's even more right with over the past year with all the turmoil that we've seen in the world. And I think for African countries, it's in particular true that they are looking on the short-term budget allocation. And of course, health is not, the only topic that they have to tackle. So then it's a matter of prioritization. And what we're trying to do is to put back the prioritization on health because we are trying to move them from being more on the reactive to a proactive strategy planning on investment on health, meaning we're not asking to unlock fund today or in the coming week, but we're asking them to allocate the proper funding to fight a non-communicable disease and infectious disease in the coming decade and century. And that's really about planning and not being reactive on those topics.
If I can just ask you about localization, which is critical to this debate, if it's going to be meaningful, how can it be if IP and tech, for instance, still remain controlled in Europe?
Yeah, so look, the reality, and I'm talking here on Sanofi, not the entire industry. I mean, we have our own strategy in that regard. When you look at it today, Sanofi is producing roughly 2.5 million doses of a vaccine every day, right? And obviously, if we want to keep sustaining the proper vaccine allocation and to respond to the needs of the continent in Africa, we cannot do it alone. And it's not only with our network in Europe. And that's why in Sanofi, we have decided long ago to have a strategy of localization and technical transfer to support the country in terms of sovereignty. And this was long enough before COVID, and COVID just put additional pressure or just a reality check. Because when COVID pandemic happened in Africa, they were at the end of the queue. And this is where all the governments realized that, again, talking about investment, the localization and technical transfer to produce its own vaccine with the support of a private partner like Sanofi is what needs to be done to ensure sustainability of access of vaccine for the population.
So let me ask you this then. If a new pandemic were to hit tomorrow, do you think Africa would have more control materially than it maybe had 5 years ago?
Well, if it's tomorrow, I would say we're not there yet. But bear in mind that a localization, a technical transfer for biologicals like vaccines, the cycle of technical transfer, because it's extremely complex and controlled, you talk about for one doses of vaccine, probably more than 1,000 tests before it gets injected. So you can imagine that such technical transfer will take at least 3, 4 years sometimes to have an effective technical transfer before they produce their first doses. So compared to 5 years, what happened is that some of the projects have been initiated. In South Africa, the reality is that there is one that is very effective today in application, as BioVac in South Africa, a local company, biotech company, is producing vaccines for the immunization program in South Africa. But that's really it. And the rest is or still remain projects. And because it's been initiated 2-3 years ago, we're not there yet at the stage where they actually produce. But we are on the way. And I think there is a major understanding at all countries level, supranational organization in Africa, African Union, Africa CDC, all stakeholders, I think, are embarked with us in this journey, and we're happy to support.
That's the technical and logistic side, but millions of people still can't afford basic NCD medicines. It's difficult, surely, for the pharmaceutical industry to justify the pricing model today.
Yes, so we do operate through different models. Obviously, it depends on the kind of country you refer to, because even in Africa, it's not all low middle-income country or low-income country. South Africa is quite a rich country, in fact, in the Africa context. But we operate through different models. We have the basic, the classical commercial model, but we have also a global health unit that is dedicated to support additionally those low-income countries where they set price in a way that is affordable for those population and those countries. Furthermore, it's not only about access on the drugs, it's also because once you solve the access in terms of price and affordability, you also have logistical issues when population and communities in some of the country, despite the drugs being available and affordable, can't access it, literally, physically access it. And this is where there is, for instance, an impact investment fund that has been injected up to $25 million into some of the local companies and startup in order to support what we call the last mile delivery to support access. So how do we get those drugs actually in the community, to the community, so that they can actually treat themselves? So that is also our work.
Live at the B20 in Sandton, that is Jean-Baptiste Brejean, who is head of Sanofi South Africa. Thank you very much indeed.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
One of South Africa's sharpest pens and most fearless satirists, Jonathan Shapiro, we know him better as Zapiro, has released his new 2025 compendium. It's called What Else Could Go Wrong? And from the corridors of power, I guess, to the chaos of social media, Zapiro has once again held up a mirror to the country with equal parts humor and discomfort. And he joins me now to talk about what shaped this year's work and how he keeps finding fresh ways to poke the powerful. Jonathan, when you sat down and welcomed you to assemble this book, what was the single defining story or emotion that you felt capture the year? Are you able to put your finger on it, or is that a tough one?
It's always a tough one, and I sometimes might go for three different things and say any one of those could be part of the kind of zeitgeist. It could work. The things that I was thinking about were the GNU. I know it's not a proper government of national unity. It is a grand coalition, which we call a government of national unity, but the new itself, which is a character that I kind of lifted from my 1994 proper, you know, Madiba GNU, to do something with about all the kind of problems associated with that was one of the things. To do something about Trump and how he's affecting the world and us and our relationship with Trump was another thing. To do the problems of stuff all over the world, including kind of Gaza, the US, Sudan, South Africa. I wasn't sure about this one. And I actually think I did three proper mock-ups of covers and titles, and none of them was completely right. And it was my good friend, Mike Wills, who I do the captions with for these books, who said, what about the cartoon you did of the new crashing down, the sort of Chapman's Peak, and then this big boulder about to land on it. And it's in that cartoon, it said, what else could go wrong?
Right.
And there's the boulder above, which is Trump tariffs. And I hadn't even spotted that as a cover. And once I did that, it definitely gelled, because it's got the combination of our stuff and Trump and all of those things. What else could go wrong? Is poised, which I like as well.
Jonathan, I never ask an interviewee a question and then attempt to answer it myself, but in this case, I'm going to do it. The question to you is, which cartoon in this edition maybe pushed you the hardest creatively or politically? And I'm going to answer that and say, if you go to page 108, it's the vivid, stark, difficult, sinister picture of the Israeli Prime Minister. Never can we, all of the people, you say, be compared with the Nazis. And you can describe the cartoon to me if that's one of the cartoons that you maybe really thought hard about.
Jeremy, that is exactly the cartoon. I mean, if you'd asked me that and you hadn't primed me to say, go to that page, well, I'm glad you did, because I wouldn't have known what page it's on. But yes, that is the most difficult, the starkest cartoon in this annual. Look, I've been doing these kind of things for a long, long time on Israel and Palestine, but this one is pretty tough. And so you've got Netanyahu looking very, very ominous and very close up. Never can we of all people be compared with Nazis. The talk balloons are sort of split so that you get that kind of slight pause. But he is in a full Gestapo uniform. And for the first time, I've gone far enough with the Magen David on the Star of David.
Yeah.
But with the two stripes of the flag, it's not just the Magen David, which is a religious symbol. It is the flag, but it is transposed there as an alternative swastika on his sleeve. And then all the aspects of dehumanization and ethnic cleansing and torture, these are all sort of badges and medals on him. They bomb hospitals, target journalists, target elderly, target children, target food queues. These are things that are absolutely akin to the Nazis and to fascists and to the extermination kind of ideas that so it's not the same as 6 million people, you know, people killed in gas ovens and forest massacres and gas ovens and things. But there are other kinds of massacres happening in Gaza at the behest of Netanyahu and his right-wing government. So it's not every Israeli. It's not every. Certainly, it's not about Jews. It's about Netanyahu and how atrocious this government is and the genocide that they are undertaking. Yeah.
Jonathan, we're having this conversation as the G20 summit begins this weekend. And I think South Africa's G20 presidency has produced its own drama. How does the events of this week and this coming weekend open up for you creatively? What are you looking for?
Well, there are a number of things. One thing I'm thinking about a lot because of Trump and because of that boycott. I mean, there are a number of cartoons in this annual about Trump's misinformation and mischaracterization of South Africa as a place where there's this so-called, you know, white genocide, Afrikaners being exterminated and absolute rubbish, and it affects the whole world because it has actually meant that he is limiting, he wants to limit immigration to the United States. So he's made it even smaller, and he's allowing the supposed refugees from South Africa. So it's affected now he's actually boycotting, and he has enormous influence and he has enormous power. So that's one of the things I'm thinking about. Of course, the cleanup of Johannesburg, the idea that they clean up a place to allow foreign dignitaries and powerful people to come in there, but they don't do it for the locals. And that's another thing. Whether or not we can establish ourselves in some way as independent of this kind of these right-wing populists like Trump and that kind of power broking, we can establish ourselves in some way and get something good coming out of this G20. I'm not sure. I hope so. But multilateralism is really under threat from, especially from Trump. So those are things I'm thinking about, yeah.
published by Jacana. The annual is called What Else Could Go Wrong? And the interviewee, the person I've been talking to, the cartoonist, is Jonathan Shapiro Zapiro. Jonathan, thank you very much indeed. And that's where we are going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb. Your trusted source for business and investment insights.